Thanks, Terry. Though no church has seen fit to canonize him, he was nevertheless a saint. It's what one writer said about another writer, the 19th century Russian physician and short story writer and playwright Anton Chekhov. Kind of strong praise, if you ask me. But I rather like a poem that a guy named Lewis Simpson wrote about an incident in Chekhov's life. Now, I know I'm taking a risk here. This is a lot of literary stuff right off the bat. I'm thinking you'll enjoy this poem, but if not, I hear the muffins are worth the wait. The poem is called Chocolates. Once, some people were visiting Chekhov. While they made remarks about his genius, the master fidgeted. Finally, he said, "Do you like chocolates?" They were astonished and silent. He repeated the question, whereupon one lady plucked up her courage and murmured shyly, "Yes." "Tell me," he said, leaning forward, light glinting from his spectacles, "what kind? The light, sweet chocolate or the dark, bitter kind?" The conversation became general. They spoke of cherry centers, of almonds and Brazil nuts. Losing their inhibitions, they interrupted one another. For people may not know what they think about politics in the Balkans or the vexed question of men and women, but everyone has a definite opinion about the flavor of shredded coconut. Finally, someone spoke of chocolates filled with liqueur, and everyone, even the author of Uncle Vanya, was at a loss for words. As they were leaving, he stood by the door and took their hands. In the coach returning to Petersburg, they agreed it had been a most unusual conversation. You know, I think I'd like to talk about chocolate today. Isn't that different? I'd like to talk about chocolate rather than asking what it might mean to say Christ is risen in this maddening world of ours, in this world of ISIS or ISIL, soldiers beheading people, in this world where nearly 150 Kenyans were killed this week at a college, as Islamic militants from Somalia targeted the college, especially non-Muslims and in particular Christians, in this world where outside the building on the campus of Duke University that houses its diversity office, someone hung a noose even as their integrated basketball team was preparing to play in the Final Four. Of course, I could avoid all that. It's not like you have to choose between talking about chocolate or about Easter. I could talk about Easter as if it were chocolate, or maybe marshmallow peeps if you like those better, something sweet and delicious that no one finds challenging at all. But that really isn't Easter. An Easter that doesn't speak to the world as it is isn't really Easter. Besides, I need an Easter that speaks to the depth of my heart, my mind, my soul. I need an Easter that speaks to a sometimes messed up and maddening world, a world in which a young German pilot decides life isn't worth living anymore and takes dozens of people with him into death. A world where I hear the news of a young woman who goes missing from Dinkytown, and my first reaction is fear, because my daughter lives near there. And then when the police no longer suspect foul play, there's a bit of relief. But that's quickly followed by heartache when I think about what her family must be going through and what led her to take her own life. Talking about chocolate could be a lot easier. But I really do want to know what it means to say Christ is risen, and say it in our world today. To say Christ is risen is to talk about hope. Not an easy optimism that everything will just turn out all right, but a hope caked with mud. A hope that sees the worst in the world and still gives us the courage to act in the world to make a difference, to make it better. The story, after all, doesn't move from Palm Sunday to an Easter parade. It moves through betrayal and agony and injustice and cruelty and death, and then hope. To say Christ is risen is to talk about joy, not a joy that ignores the difficulties in our lives and in the world, but a joy that sees fully and still perceives moments for joy. I appreciate the words of Darcy Steinke in her memoir, Easter Everywhere. Love the title of it. Life is brutal, full of horror and violence. Life is beautiful, full of passion and joy. Both things are true at the same time. And I think she's right about that. To say Christ is risen is to sense deep down in our bones that in the end love wins. That's what the source of our hope and joy is. In the end, love wins. And in our world, love often seems down for the count. Aggressive power and violence seem so dauntingly strong. Fear seems so powerful. But Easter reminds us that love is the true, lasting power. It will finally not be defeated. Try as the world might, love wins. It rises again and again. And because of that, there are always fresh possibilities. To say Christ is risen is to trust in a God of love who is actively engaged in the world. A theologian, I think, puts it well. God is reaching into the world continuously at every moment, all the time. But the fingers of God are not things you can see with your eyes. They are fresh possibilities for healing and wholeness, for love and wonder. They come in surprising ways. Christians call them grace. Always they are healing and hopeful, the best for the situation at hand. The best may not be the ideal. In the middle of a wilderness, the best may be sheer survival or humor or courage or sleep. But always it is a realized hope, a fresh possibility. To say Christ is risen is to say something like what the writer and theologian Frederick Buechner says. Anxiety and fear are what we know best in this fantastic century of ours. He's writing in the last century. And still, it's kind of sad the words apply so well to our century. Anxiety and fear are what we know best in this fantastic century of ours. Wars and rumors of wars. We have heard so much tragic news that when good news is good, we cannot hear it. But the proclamation of Easter Day is that all is well. Love is the victor. Existence has greater depths of beauty, mystery, and benediction than the wildest visionary has ever dared to dream. And we know all that. And we trust it at some level. But it can be sometimes so difficult to see and affirm. But you know what? It's always been hard to see. It's always been difficult to get a glimpse of the working of this God of hope and joy and love and fresh possibility. At first, Mary Magdalene sees nothing but an empty tomb. Confused and startled, she runs for Peter and for another disciple who doesn't even get his name in the book. And they find an empty tomb, and Peter and that other disciple are at a loss, and they go home. Mary stays and begins to gain a little bit of sight, but it is blurred. When she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she still did not know it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you looking for?" Supposing him to be the gardener. I really like that line in the story. Supposing him to be the gardener. God is reaching into the world continuously at every moment, all the time, but the fingers of God are not easy to see with your eyes. It takes Mary a while to see the fingers of God at work. Christ is risen, but we are in pretty good company. If at first we see nothing but the gardener. Christ is risen, and the God who raised Jesus continues to reach into the world continuously at every moment, all the time. But we don't always see it, at least not readily, at least not easily. Philip Gully is a writer and a Quaker pastor. He tells a story about the call he received to the second church he ever pastored. He begins the story by saying he got fired from the first church he ever pastored because they didn't like his theology. So when he went to preach a trial sermon for the next church, he decided he would preach a very liberal sermon because he had heard the congregation was kind of conservative, and if they didn't want him, well, at least he wouldn't have to be there for a little while and get fired again. Among the call committee was a gentleman named Dick. After the sermon and the call committee met, Dick came out to talk to Philip and broke the news to him. "We've reached agreement," Dick said. "We've agreed that none of us liked your sermon. We've also agreed to call you to be our pastor." And that afternoon, Dick invited Pastor Philip to play golf. And the next day they went out and Dick beat Philip by 10 strokes. And he said, "A preacher who can't preach or play golf, what have we gotten ourselves into?" And Philip says, "Dick and I became fast friends. When I preached a sermon he didn't like, I was always the first to know. We golfed once a month. I never beat him. Then his elderly mother died, and I conducted her funeral. It was about then that Dick started liking my sermons. I never did figure out if it was because I was changing or Dick was." Philip pastored that church for 4 years. And the year after he left, he ran into Dick at the hospital and found out that Dick's wife was dying, and she died shortly thereafter. Dick asked Philip if he would come and officiate at the funeral. Philip had a rule about not going back to former churches to do weddings or funerals, but he said in this case he felt he had to make an exception. 5 years before, Philip thought he'd taken a chance on me, and I figured that put me in his debt. And then a couple of years later, Dick died, and Philip officiated at his funeral as well. And here's how we reflected on that. "At the funeral, I talked with some folks about how Christians these days can't seem to get along, how we fuss and fight and draw our theological lines in the sand. I told them how Dick and I were poles apart sometimes, but we made up our minds that disagreeing about God would never keep us from loving God's children. It's good to know where you stand, but it's even better to have your heart turned toward gentleness. Dick ended up changing me in ways I needed to be changed. I'd like to think I did the same for him. Maybe that's what God has in mind when God brings different folks together, that we each bring our scraps of truth and piece them together into this radiant quilt that is so much finer than anything we could have made alone." For me, that story says something about what it means to say, "Christ is risen." It's to see these small moments of hope and joy and peace and love and fresh possibility. It is to see that the God who raised Jesus continues to reach into the world at every moment, all the time, even when the fingers of God can sometimes be hard to detect. Part of our job as a community that proclaims Christ is risen is to help others see. It's to bring our scraps of truth and insight and piece them together into this radiant quilt that is much finer than anything we could ever make alone. And another part of our job as a community that proclaims Christ is risen is to be part of that work of God in the world, to let Christ rise in us, to let Christ rise in the world through us. And it doesn't have to be a big production, and in fact, most of the time it won't be. It's just being a part of the quiet work of love, trusting that in the end, love wins. When they left that conversation with Chekhov, they agreed that it had been a most unusual conversation. If they'd been in Minnesota, they probably would have said to each other, "Well, that's different." When we encounter the risen Christ in all those small ways, that the risen Christ shows up, we are made different. We're made different so we can make a difference. Christ is risen. Look for it. See it. Christ is risen. Be a part of it. Amen. We're going to sing a song called Lord, I Lift Your Name on High. We would invite you again to stand as you're able. The song is found, the words will be up behind me, and the song is found in the Faith We Sing, the thinner songbook around you, 2088.